Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for May 18th, 2023. Tonight I'm going to start out talking about the James Webb Telescope. There's a lot of chatter on the internet that the recent findings, since this has been, since it was brought online, and the James Webb Telescope is, of course, the latest space telescope. It has a very wide spectral range to observe astronomical phenomenon. And it has a tremendous, tremendous imaging capability. So the question is, did it discover something that disproves the Big Bang Theory? Well, the Big Bang Theory should have never, ever gotten roots in the first place. That's just the actuality, the reality of the situation, because the fundamental science that was done originally was very poor. Let's just put it that way. But then again, you can always look back, and whether it's a political situation, scientific situation, or whatever, it's always easy to judge. 20/20 vision, looking into the past, is, like they say, vision is always 20/20. But the, for example, there's some basics for the Big Bang, some very fundamental pillars, and I've talked about these extensively. You can read about these in my books, in my coursework that I've developed online, etc. But basically, there are a couple pillars. And before I get started on this, I want to mention also that I want to talk about population growth. I'll be talking about volcanoes that have tornadoes in them, and a little bit about current events dealing with, because I've been talking recently about the Communist Manifesto being implemented in the United States, and that is already here. It's already on the way. But okay, so back to the Big Bang. The basic pillars that it rests on are general relativity, which is incorrect. Special relativity is a different story. Special relativity has been well tested and well verified, but general relativity has not been verified. Very rudimentary experiments that have never been repeated, the Eddington experiment, etc., was very poorly done. Eddington cherry-picked the data and of the photographs that he took of the total eclipse in the early 1900s. Eddington cherry-picked the data. And if you look at the total photo set that he took, he just picked a few data points that matched what he was looking for, and other than that, none of the data fit at all. Okay, so anyway, it should have, general relativity should have never gotten, in fact, it disproved general relativity. Okay, so anyway, I'm not going to go into all the details regarding that. When I was at Cornell, after school session one time, they always had these after-class sessions up in the astrophysics astronomy department, and I would go up there to see what was the new data coming in, etc. And there was one where there was a Venus probe. There was a, it was orbiting Venus, so they knew the exact position. So they decided to measure the bending of the radio waves coming from the transmitter on the satellite orbiting Venus as Venus went around and tracked around behind the sun. Very simple experiment, should have verified general relativity. And it should have, because they knew exactly where Venus was, it should have caused the bending of light, and it should have been very easy to determine, because with visible light, very difficult, but with radio signals, it should have been fairly easy because you don't have that interference of light from the sun in the, that you would have in the visible spectrum. So anyway, the radio waves that were coming from this satellite should have progressively bent, meaning that it would appear that they're coming from a location closer to the sun. In other words, the light or electromagnetic radiation bending around the sun. And as Venus started to pass near the limb of the sun and started to go behind the sun, it started, the position of this satellite started bouncing all over the place, and of course, they knew exactly where the satellite was. They had been tracking it. It was in a stable orbit around Venus. And so but the actual radio signal was bouncing back and forth all over the place. So it disproved general relativity. But of course, these are known tier two scientists that worked for NASA. And so they scuttled the data. They said, well, it doesn't, you know, everybody's afraid to disprove something that's so-called established. And so the so-called tests of general relativity have all failed. You can't get a black hole in your laboratory, so you got to go out and get secondary images and information and then interpret it. And of course, a couple years ago, scientists came out. They said they took a picture of a black hole. Well, complete nonsense. Complete nonsense. And a big announcement. They were all vying for a Nobel Prize. That's what's going on in the political world today of science. Okay. The other two basic things that the Big Bang rests on is the redshift, that with the idea that, in the course, special relativity is well proven that if something's moving away from you, it produces a redshift. Well, that's all fine and good, but what they didn't plan on was that there was another source of redshift. The redshift that's causing all of these redshifted readings, stars and quasars and galaxies, etc., as we peer out into the universe. And so it's the real situation is that there is a second source of redshift, something I discovered is laboratory provable, called the induced electric dipole redshift. And it's a localized condition around stars with non-uniform electric fields that are caused by the fusion process. So anyway, okay, so the redshift that they've been using for the Hubble constant and Hubble calculations, etc., is simply wrong. The redshift of so-called everything moving away from us is due to localized conditions from fusion-based stars or galactic nuclei or quasars, etc. Then the next thing is the microwave background radiation. Microwave background radiation, they predicted this based on the Big Bang, that there should be an even 3-degree Kelvin microwave background radiation as a signature of the Big Bang explosion. But when they looked out, it was blotchy. It wasn't consistent, so that was one of the first indicators. Just like the other experiments for general relativity, it should have told them that, hey, this isn't correct. But they misinterpreted the data, fudged it, basically, to say, oh, yeah, that's what we were expecting. And just there's other things like this happen, like the surface of the sun. When they believed that the solar furnace, the fusion furnace, was down deep in the core, then the end result would have been a perfectly smooth orange ball, and that's what the sun looks like at a distance from Earth before you get really good equipment where you can actually look at the sun and the sun's surface, where it's blotchy, it has all kinds of activity on the surface, magnetic fields, all of this going on. Should have told them, our model is not correct. The core fusion model cannot be correct because you have all this surface activity going on. And it's a basic physics problem that predicts the very even surface. It's called the random walk. And so if you have fusion going on in the core, the X-rays that transmit the energy, they move, they are reabsorbed by a nuclei, they are re-emitted out to again, and then they are reabsorbed and re-emitted. And after this is done, unbelievable, almost an infinite number of times before this energy reaches the surface, it should be distributed perfectly evenly over the entire surface of the sun, and it's not. It is not. It is very much different. So that should have told them that the core fusion model was wrong. All of these instances where physics experiments totally contradicted the anticipated result, and still they were they verified the so-called theories. This is the Big Bang, general relativity, core fusion model of the sun. And so the with the microwave background radiation measurements, they turned out to be blotchy. And they had high concentrations and low concentrations. And instead of understanding that this was not due to some kind of Big Bang residue, microwave black body radiation, it should have disproven the Big Bang at that point. And it turns out that all they're seeing is this cloud of dust and gas that surrounds the solar system, which has, by the way, about a couple degree black body microwave background radiation view. That's what it looks like. But what it really is going on is that's the region around the Kuiper Belt where thousands and thousands of planets are forming. And that was another thing. Remember when you studied in school that there were nine planets and it went from Mercury out to Pluto? And all of a sudden, they start discovering thousands, literally thousands of planets outside of Pluto. And they go, doggone, we got a problem here. Our theory on how the solar system forms doesn't account for all of these planets. And so they decided to demote Pluto from being a planet because most of these were Pluto-sized. Some of them are Jupiter-sized. And so there are now tens of thousands of planets out there that they're just pretending kind of, yeah, they're out there, but we don't really talk about those because it doesn't fit into the standard 4.5 billion-year-old solar system nursery rhyme. Okay, so at any rate, now comes along the James Webb Telescope. The Hubble Space Telescope had been up there, and remember the situation that was with all previous astronomical telescopes. There were regions that were just black. There was nothing there. The best telescopes, Earth-based telescopes, etc., radio telescopes, would look into this region, and it was just black, nothing there. Okay, so the Hubble telescope goes up, and they train it on this black area to see if there's anything there, and there's millions of galaxies there. And, what's the problem here? Well, they had counted on those black areas indicating that, no, there's nothing beyond there. So, as with any data that comes in for the astronomical community, they don't interpret the data the way it should have been. They interpret it to promote their pet theories, notably the Big Bang. Okay, so that should have told you right there at the Hubble, once the Hubble was up. And this had been going on. This is not the first incident where somebody built a bigger telescope, looked out into a black region, and lo and behold, there's a lot of stuff there. And so this should have told people that at least up to the point we're at now in time, in the development of telescopes, that the that no matter how big a telescope we built to date, we always see more stuff out to the limit of that telescope. Then we build a bigger telescope, and then we see more stuff in the areas that used to be black. So the Hubble telescope should have told people that, hey, there's something wrong here with the Big Bang theory. It's not accounting for what we see. Now here comes the James Webb Telescope. Well, these Looney Tune astronomers and university professors, NASA scientists, the Tier 2 ones at least, they had already made their prediction, their calculation, that the universe was 13.5 billion years old. And so that's the time going back to the so-called Big Bang. Along comes the James Webb Telescope, looks out beyond where the Hubble can see, and what does it see? Young galaxies. Well, wait a minute. There's two things going on here. One is the redshift, which is misinterpreted, and one is simply the fact that now we have better telescopes. We're looking out into these dark regions that nobody could see anything before, including the Hubble Space Telescope had lots of dark patches out there where there was supposedly nothing. And all of a sudden, the James Webb Telescope comes along and sees stuff in those dark areas. Not only does it see stuff, it sees galaxies that are very young and also very fully developed. And so how could these fully developed galaxies be out there if they are all approaching the window of the Big Bang, supposedly 13.5 billion years ago? There's not enough time for them to develop. So in that case, it's just another punch in the face of the Big Bang theory. But you don't hear anybody in the astronomical community raising any fuss. They're making comments like, gee, everything we knew was false. But the end result is they're going to come along. Remember, there was string theory, then there was bubble theory, then there was on and on, these different theoretical approaches to saying, oh, well, they're trying to rationalize the data after it comes out, and then everybody rallies around that. Oh, that explains it. But it's still often never, never land. The theoretical structure in cosmology today is simply fairy tales science. These guys live in their little isolated hamlets up in the ivory towers of universities, and they don't have to answer to anybody. They publish in peer reviews journals that are refereed by their buddies. And so this life cycle of bad cosmology just continues. So to answer the question, a lot of people are starting to wake up that Big Bang, you know, it's really the fairy tale science. The James Webb Telescope provided amazing data that really pushes it to the limit. And, you know, none of the predictions now can be vilified. And so anyway, let's put this into perspective. Let's go back to the beginning of the Big Bang Theory, which was the expanding universe. Edwin Hubble has nice telescopes, looks out and sees galaxies for the first time, puts spectroscopic equipment on his telescope, sees everything redshifted, very good observation, and then says, hey, all this stuff is redshifted, therefore it must be moving away from us. So the universe must be expanding. Not only are we in this like blast coming out from the so-called original Big Bang, but then the idea is that if everything is expanding, then if you go back in time, everything should come together to a point, which is not a foregone conclusion. So the idea that things are expanding, that's one issue. But then to extrapolate that back and say everything began in this teeny-weeny pinpoint because we don't have data from all the other objects in the universe. If we went out and we had instrumentation, telescopes, spectrometers, and good equipment, and we sent it out to all the different locations in the universe and then reported back, and if all of that data corresponded with, if you went back in time, if you reversed everything, so to speak, would it all come to a single point? And even then it would be questionable, and I doubt if the data would verify that. So to extrapolate, and this is kind of like Darwin's evolution, where he looks and he sees animal variations from one point to another, and then he goes out to islands, and he sees variations which look like similar birds and animals on shore, on the mainland, and he sees them on islands with little changes, like the beak is different or things like that. And he goes, oh, these things are changing, they're adapting, which is something that every generation of humans is adapting. Every generation of zebras is adapting. Every generation of sharks would be adapting in some way or another, although what we find is over long term they're very, very stable. But the idea is that these adaptions, now Darwin goes, oh, okay, what we're going to do is extrapolate this over billions of years and then state that species come from other species. In other words, man came from the ape. Supposedly there was this genetic train of development, and Carl Sagan latched onto this in his Cosmos series and made it a fundamental part of science. And remember the Cosmos series, when I was at Cornell in 1979-81, Carl wasn't there. He was in Hollywood making the Cosmos series. And so he would come back and give lectures and things like that. He was off becoming a movie star in Hollywood making the Cosmos series. But that took and solidified. They needed a solidification of science. So they had the Big Bang, which was total evolution, no design, no grand plan, simply popped out of nowhere. And a couple billion years later, people are walking around planet Earth. What could be wrong with that? And it was to solidify Darwin's evolution on a cosmic scale, that the stars, the galaxies, the planets, everything associated, the physical part of the universe was part of evolution. And of course, it's totally wrong. Because if we're seeing galaxies, now we go out and we look with the James Webb Telescope, out 10 to maybe 15 billion light years away, and we're seeing stuff that looks just like what we got here, then where's the evolution, boys and girls? No, what it tells us is what I've been saying all along. This is a steady-state universe. We are unable to see the edge of the universe, certainly not with the redshift, because the redshift interpretation is wrong. And certainly not with the bigger and bigger telescope, because someday, now they're talking about putting telescopes on the moon, bigger than the James Webb Telescope. And so every time you build a bigger one, the resolution gets better, the light-gathering power gets better, and you can see farther. So now all of a sudden you're going to have telescopes on the moon. There's no atmosphere, there's no issue with it. In fact, I think it's a bad idea because you have a dust problem on the moon. It's electrostatic dust, but it's a problem. And so I think that putting telescopes in space around Earth where we can service them, where we can get at them if something goes wrong, and the space is no clearer around the moon than it is around Earth. So moon-based telescopes, I think, are a bad idea, a very bad idea. And they're far away. They're hard to set up. You gotta land all this stuff on the moon. You got to overcome the gravity of the moon. And then you have the dust problem. When you bring a rocket ship down, it's going to have dust blowing all over the place. So anyway, telescopes on the moon, very bad idea. Anyway, back to putting bigger and bigger telescopes in space. There will be bigger telescopes than the James Webb Telescope, I presume, someday, and have more capability, and maybe even radio telescopes that are huge, that can span, instead of like the kind that they built in China recently, or the Arecibo telescope, which, of course, now is defunct. I think they ruined it on purpose. Be that as it may, it was certainly due to neglect, if not intentional, the Arecibo telescope facility being destroyed because of lack of attention, because cables broke. Good grief. Anyway, and those cables don't break. They're designed to last a lifetime or five lifetimes. But anyway, about space telescopes, someday there will probably be bigger telescopes than the James Webb Telescope that will see farther, and they will peer out into the dark areas that the James Webb Telescope is seeing and see other things, millions of galaxies. So it just keeps going on and on. So in terms of our ability to see into outer space and measure the size of the universe, We're not hit it yet. And look, you might build a telescope and say, well, look, we finally hit the edge of the universe. We just can't see anything out there. There's this dark area. And that's what they thought before. And then the Hubble goes up there and they point the Hubble at this dark area and there's millions of galaxies. So even if you see a dark area, all that means is your telescope resolution and light gathering power isn't enough to see anything in that dark area. That's all it is. That's all it's telling you. And literally, you could never, ever build a telescope that ultimately is going to see to infinity and to resolve things that are to infinity, because 13 billion light years away in terms of infinity is not much. Not much at all. Okay, so anyway, that is the situation with the James Webb Telescope. And if anything, the James Webb Telescope woke up a lot of people to the fact that the Big Bang Theory is incorrect. The next question is, what's going to happen about replacing it? And there again, you get into the politics of science, where these scientists want to hold on to everything they can, because guess what? Hey, their paycheck depends on it. Their paycheck. In their cush job, sitting in a university, not doing anything, just occupying a chair, would go away. And where are those clowns going to get a job? A real job. Nowhere. You know, maybe running a McDonald's hamburger stand someplace. Can you imagine one of those PhDs, you know, going into McDonald's? What's your qualifications? Well, a PhD in astronomy, astrophysics. Worked at the Harvard Institute for cosmology or whatever, you know, Cornell University astrophysics department. And the guy interviewing at McDonald's hamburger stand goes, well, I think you're overqualified. As soon as you get a job in your area, you're going to be gone. So why would we hire you? Anyway, just a quick mention. Every day, NASA puts out a list of sometimes anywhere between as maybe as little as 10, but usually around 50 to 60 asteroids that are potential colliding with Earth. They're close. They're coming close to Earth, but not really close. Maybe a couple lunar distances or something like that. And they announce these as if they're danger to Earth. They are not dangerous to Earth because the vast majority of these are in orbit around Earth. So it would be like imagining that our moon, somebody saying, oh, doggone, that moon is one lunar distance away. That's pretty scary. But the moon does not have danger of crashing into Earth because it's in orbit around Earth. There's nobody running around going, oh, the moon is going to crash into Earth. No, because it's in orbit around Earth. And so that's the case with the vast, vast majority of these asteroids that they're claiming are a threat to Earth. And they're doing it. They're inflating tremendously the numbers of these Earth-threatening asteroids to get funding. But the reality is, like I say, in fact, yesterday, for example, I looked at the chart, out of about 65 claimed near-Earth asteroids that were at their closest approach to Earth, only one was non-Earth orbiting. In other words, it was one that came in from a distance, was going to zip around Earth and then head out and go away. It was not going to be captured. And how do these get captured? Well, the moon does it. The moon-Earth system is a perfect situation, a twin two gravitational bodies. And so the Earth-Moon system is constantly capturing these asteroids by a energy transfer. It's a gravitational transfer using gravity to capture these into Earth orbits. And once they're there, they're going to stay there. And so unless somehow the moon perturbs these, they come close to the moon, and there's some kind of energy exchange, they're going to stay in these orbits. Most of them are outside the moon, and well outside the moon, many lunar distances. So there's not a big probability of them coming in and interacting with the moon and then sending them on a trajectory towards Earth. But that would be a bigger potential threat than just a random one coming from outer space, zipping through the solar system. Okay, just a quick mention here. My water filters, the MR5 whole house water filter, is listed on my sales page, the jmccwaterfilters.com webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. And you can get an extra percentage discount. Go there and see how much it is. I believe it's set at 10%. And you can get a discount by using the coupon code JMCC at checkout. But everybody needs a whole house water filter. It filters the cold and hot water in your house. It is at the point of entry. And in this world, in today's world, you need a whole house water filter because the biggest dose of toxins you get are in the daily shower. Okay, well, enough of that. I'll remind you of the webpage at the end of the show. The other day, was it 2 days ago, 16th of May, there was a grazing solar flare that came by Earth, and it knocked out shortwave. And, of course, my show airs on shortwave at the lower frequencies, down in the 5 to 9 range, megahertz range in the shortwave band, and primarily the lower frequencies were affected, starting at about 16 megahertz and then running down from there. The lower the frequency, the bigger the effect. Now, this shortwave outage was due to a passing solar flare which disrupted the ionosphere, and it lasted for about 10 minutes. Now, my show was not affected. My show was not affected by this, but I just wanted to let you know that that's one of the things that can happen. I keep my radio show, my shortwave radio show, because I believe that someday it's going to be the only way you're going to be able to listen. So you might be listening to this on a podcast or a smart device of some kind, Alexa, or all these other types of devices. You might be listening to it on a internet radio program application like Garden Radio or iTunes. You might be listening to it on Buzzsprout, or might be listening to it on some other podcast venue. It re-airs on Truth Be Told Radio Network. So all of these different ways to listen now, it's really multiplying. Almost every week I have a new way to listen. But I'm going to tell you something. If you go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, there's a subpage under the radio. It says radio program or radio show. There's a link there at the very top. Go there, and it tells you all the different ways to listen, including satellites. If you're in the Mideast, there's a satellite that re-airs, the program re-airs on Saturday, etc. So there's all these different ways to listen, but my advice is to get yourself a shortwave radio. And they can be very inexpensive. You need the lower bands, the down to at least about 3 to be comfortable. And then my radio show lists in the 5 megahertz to 9 megahertz range. I think there's one that's always playing is in the 6 megahertz range. But go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and figure out which frequency is going on. There's a wintertime frequency, a summertime frequency. And learn how to listen to this radio show on shortwave. And it's very important because there's a day coming, I can guarantee it, when you're not going to have internet. If there's a major power outage, if there's a solar flare, it might disrupt shortwave a little bit, but shortwave is heard worldwide. Now, I've traveled a lot. And I've listened, monitored my own radio show in all different parts of the world where it came in loud and clear, shortwave from Nashville, Tennessee. It's WWCR, Nashville, Tennessee. I'm on tower number 2. They have 4 100,000-watt towers there, the biggest radio station in the world, and I'm on tower number 2. And, of course, the time is 6 p.m. Central Time, Thursday evening. I've been on that slot since the year about 2000, so I'm in my 23rd year. But my recommendation, get yourself a shortwave radio. Learn how to use it, and here's a little tip. I made this by accident. I had a little kind of a cigarette pack shortwave radio. It was an FM band, AM band, shortwave, lots of shortwave bands. It was about the size of a, was bigger than a cigarette pack. It's maybe about 4 inches by 3 inches by inch and a half radio. And it had a little antenna on it, and at a place where you could plug in a shortwave antenna also. But anyway, I had this, I would always carry a headset with me, or like earphones, those little earplug things, you know, like they give you on the, on an airplane. And one time I had this, these earphones, and they had batteries in them. It was a powered, amplifier headset. And so anyway, I put this on, and I plugged it into the radio, and I picked up channels where there was just dead air on shortwave, and of course FM, any other stations, but mainly on shortwave, where this radio had the ability to pick up all those channels, and they were there, but they were such a low signal that just regular earphones, you just heard dead air, nothing. And with this powered headset, amplification headset, I was able to pick up, I mean, it was just hardly a space on that radio that didn't have some channel coming from around the world. So shortwave is really big, and it's going to continue. For example, WWCR would be a channel that you could count on during the roughest of times, and if everything goes out, then maybe there won't be anything. But there could be a time, any time in the near future, where they just shut down the internet or shut down the power, a false flag, solar flare that would think, oh, it took out everything, took out all the electricity, the grid, which could be a total false flag, or it could be real. There could be a real flare that would take out all the electricity. And of course, that would take out the internet and all of the ways of communicating. You know, maybe some very rudimentary government internet connections would be maintained for security or something, but you wouldn't get it. And so the last line of defense for communications, and it's interesting because this goes way back to, you know, remember the World War II, the family would gather around the radio to listen to the evening news and the president doing a report. And that was the main method of communication. Now it's the internet. Very few people pick up a radio and actually tune it in and listen. And I'm guilty of that myself. I got all of these. I've got computers. I got my phone with a radio app on it, and I go to that app and I listen. But there could be a day when none of that is available, and the only way to listen, and this will be one of the shows you want to listen to, by the way, is via shortwave. And so, like I say, if you're listening to any of these other venues out there, get yourself a shortwave radio. You can get them for, you know, very inexpensive, very portable. There's kinds that you crank up so you don't have to replace the batteries. That's kind of handier. There's some that have little solar panel on them. I don't know how effective those are. But there's all types of makes and models. But remember, make sure you get down to around the 3 megahertz range. A lot of cheap radios only go up through very high megahertz range. It's easier to get those high frequencies. So make sure your radio goes down to about 3 megahertz at the low end on the shortwave. And get one with FM, AM, and shortwave. That's the best thing to do. So anyway, enough of that. But just reminding you that this show airs on shortwave. And even if you don't listen to it all the time, at least you got that in the background. And like I say, I have listened to my own show, monitoring it as I'm doing it live, all around the world. And I'm feeding in, you know, from some remote place on the planet, feeding it into the station, and then I'm listening to my show in that remote location. So it's very interesting technology, but get yourself a shortwave radio. Okay. And let's see, what do we got going on here? Okay, let me quick talk about volcanoes with tornadoes. Okay, this is a real interesting topic. Now, a listener sent in a video. It was taken in around Missoula, Montana. So there's mountain ranges up there, the Rocky Mountains. And here's a big, full-blown, gray, you know, a tube tornado sticking up out of the mountains right up into the sky. And then apparently in one of the captions it said that the tornado went down in a valley and, you know, tore up a chicken coop or something. So it didn't just sit up in the mountains. It also went down the mountain and down into this valley area next to the mountains. But how does a tornado work up in the mountains? In my Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book, I talk about, I think it's that book, maybe it's in my weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather. It might be that book. But anyway, I have a photograph of Mount Vesuvius. It's a color photograph, and on a clear blue sky day, not a cloud in the sky, there's a tornado sticking right up out of the crater of Mount Vesuvius, this volcano that's in, I think it's in Italy, right? But anyway, so what's going on here? How come we got volcanoes with tornadoes coming out the top of the mountain? And the reason is because it's the highest point. So you can imagine a mountain. It's connected to ground. It's grounded. It's connected to ground, but it's way up in the sky. And so it's the closest point for discharging the vertical electric field. Okay, so that's the closest point to the ionosphere is the situation. Now, let me give you another situation which I discovered because I was watching hurricanes going out to the islands in the Hawaiian island chain. And I was trying to do analysis because they really act strange when they get out near the Hawaiian islands. So anyway, there's these two hurricanes. This was about 2018 time frame. There's these two hurricanes back to back going directly towards the big island. And they typically swing north as they move westerly. So anyway, this first hurricane is coming in, and they're warning all the people, you know, the international community, weather community is watching these two hurricanes. And the people in Hawaii are saying, the hurricanes never hit Hawaii. So I'm talking about the big island of Hawaii. It's the easternmost island, and it's the biggest one. If you took all of the other Hawaiian islands all the way out to the Midway chain, all the way out to Midway, it would, if you took all the land, square kilometers of land mass, and put it all together, it would not equal the big island. And I guess that's probably why they call it Big Island. It's the biggest one, much bigger than the other ones. What is it, Maui, Molokai, and Oahu, etc. But anyway, they say that there's never been, and this is going back to Hawaiian tradition, it goes back thousands of years, that Hawaii, the big island, has never had a hurricane. They always dissipate when they get near. And so, of course, the local islanders know this. But anyway, I started going, well, maybe there's a scientific reason for this. And here's what goes on. This is what happens. The big island is made up of many volcanoes, little volcanoes on bigger volcanoes, which are on bigger volcanoes. But ultimately, there are two big volcanoes. Mauna Kea is the one that's to the north. That's where the telescopes are, the big international telescope facilities. And that's dormant. That has been dormant for a very long time. And that's on the north. And then like the Parker Ranch is up there, thousands and thousands of acres of ranch land. Okay, so the southeastern volcano is called Mauna Loa. And of course, that's active. That's where Kilauea is, a sub-volcano down on the eastern flank of Mauna Loa. And that's the world's most active volcano. Just destroyed a bunch of houses there. But anyway, don't build your house below Mauna Kea. Not a good place. It's probably going to get subjected to a lava flow someday. Anyway, that's not the point. So there's these two hurricanes coming in off of the Pacific Ocean, swinging up the direct line to hit the big island of Hawaii. And so all of a sudden, boom, the first one just vaporizes. It just like goes to nothing. And here comes the second one, the same thing. They both vaporize. Now, there were other hurricanes in those similar seasons that went south of the big island, swung up north and hit Oahu, one of the other islands. But they didn't hit the big island. They went around it. But anyway, so I'm going, well, wow, what's going on here? These hurricanes come in and they just dissipate. Of course, there was a lot of rain. There was still some wind and everything. But the majority of the force and the rain of the hurricane dumped offshore, and these things just vaporized into thin air. And so I started looking at it, and so it comes back to the fact that Mauna Loa if you went from the seafloor off the shore of Hawaii up to the peak of Mauna Loa, it would be the tallest mountain on Earth. But because there's ocean there, we don't count that. But at any rate, it's still, 20,000 feet off the surface of the ocean to the peak there. And because it's an active volcano, there's a lot of movement. There's a lot of metallic movement very close under the surface. And so what's going on there is that maintains a continual electrical discharge from the vertical electric field, from the ionosphere, down to the peak, the caldera of Mauna Loa, which is in the southeastern side of the island. And that's the direction that the hurricanes come. They come from, they start forming over by Mexico. They go westerly, cross the Pacific Ocean, they gain energy, and then they swing up either past Hawaii or east of Hawaii, or direct, like these two were like a direct hit, and they vaporized. So what's going on is that the vertical electric field, electric current that's driving these hurricanes connects. It connects with the electrical current sheet that's going vertically out of the of Mauna Loa, and it dissipates the hurricane. It draws off its connecting electrical discharge, the thing that's powering it, and it just sucks it off onto Mauna Loa, and the hurricane dissipates. Perfectly described by my theoretical work. And of course, meteorologists have no clue, because they think hurricanes are formed by warm water. How absolutely absurd. We've seen hurricanes on planet Mars. There's no water. There's no warm water. There's no water at all. So how do hurricanes form by warm water if there's hurricanes on Mars and there's no water? Something else is clearly going on. Okay, so anyway, I'm going to jump off that because I only got about 8-9 minutes left to go here. But that's somebody wrote in and they sent this video of a tornado coming out the top of a mountain in Missoula, Montana, and that's what's going on. It's all part of the vertical electric field, and that mountain is the very tippity-top grounded land. And, of course, it's the first thing that's going to connect to the vertical electric field, and that's also what drives the tornadoes. The tornado is just a cyclonic storm, just like a hurricane, but it's smaller. Okay. Power of two. Okay, so I started this because I've been studying archaeological issues. Now we're very sure that there were four major pole shifts in the last 120,000 years. It's very clear. So these are major celestial events where a large planetary-type object comes by Earth, and in the form of a comet, of course. You have to understand that, put it in context. And it's not the only time things have happened, because we had the Noah's Flood, which was not a pole shift event, just where Earth flew through the tail of a large comet for a period of, they say, 40 days, 40 nights, but who knows, just a long time, and caused a worldwide torrential rain for that period of time. Okay, and also blotting out of light, so you would have glaciation, a raising of the sea levels. Okay, so, but that was not a pole shift. But anyway, when these major Earth events happen, it reduces the population down to a very low number. So what I did is I said, okay, let's imagine there's a worldwide catastrophe. We know, for example, that the Greeks generated their, what we call the ancient Greeks, the Socrates and Aristotle and those guys, Plato, that they came from sheep herders that survived one of these events up in the mountains. And they came down and generated the ancient Greek cultures and everything. But anyway, imagine that there were 1,000 people that, and why do I say 1,000 people? Because you need more than about 500 to 1,000 to prevent inbreeding. If you have fewer than that, you're going to get inbreeding and it ain't going to work. And so you have to keep the generation pool fairly large, at least 1,000. Okay, so at any rate, here we have 1,000 people, and I'm going to use the 7% annual growth rate that is existent today in third world countries, because they have a mortality rate of about 50% of kids younger than 10 years old. There's about a 50% mortality rate. And even with that, they have a 7% annual growth rate. And so here's what happens. With a 7% annual growth rate in population, that would mean that after 1 year, the 1,000 people would be 1,070 people. And then it would compound interest, so to speak. But anyway, okay. So what happens over a 10-year period is the population doubles. So you go from 1,000 to 2,000. Okay, that's over a 10-year period. So now if you double every 10 years and you carry that out 10 times, you get a 1,000-fold increase. So over a period of 100 years, you have to excuse me, I still have this voice issue going on, a weak voice. Okay, but after 10 years, you double the population. Now go 10 years, 20 years. So the population would double every 10 years. If you do that over a 100-year period, you multiply the population by 1,000. So those original 1,000 people, after only 100 years, have 1,000,000 people, 1,000 times 1,000. And after another 100 years, that 1,000,000 people turns into 1,000,000,000 people. And that's where we are in the world today. We are seeing China and India with populations of about 1,000,000,000 people, and they could have started that in historical times, but of course there's other contributing factors here. That's in a perfect world. There have been wars. There have been famine. There now is a situation where the Chinese are actually killing little kids, little girls, because they want to slow down their population. But there's resource issues. Is there enough food for the people? Wars which wipe out big portions of the male population. And so anyway, there's all of these other factors going on. But what we're seeing now in the Western countries, whether it's Australia, New Zealand, China, and even Japan, United States, Canada, England, and Europe, and Russia even, what we're seeing is a drastic decline in population, where this is for the people who were, let's just call it like it is, the white populations, because they're waiting longer to get married, they're not having as many kids, they're waiting longer to have kids, and so the population is really drastically being reduced. But what is happening in the third world countries, in Latin American, the Arab countries, and African countries, the blacks, what's going on is they are continuing the population growth as a third world country. And so a lot of these now are coming into the United States as illegal aliens, whatever term you want to use. But the idea is that they are going to drastically increase the population. So, for example, in the United States, if you had not had illegal immigration, the population of the United States now would be around 270 million people and falling, dropping, to the point where in another 20 to 40 years, the population of the U.S. would be half of that. Now, look at the population that is just exploding worldwide in the third world countries. They are on that exponential rise to, once you get up to 500 million people, then it goes exponential. And very quickly you have a billion people, and then, like I say, if you wait over a 100-year period after a billion, you would literally have a trillion people. Now, this story has a lot of aspects to it, so I'll continue this next week, talking about the political situation and the installation of the Communist Manifesto in the United States, to the point where they will be forcing people in the United States to have 3, 4, 5 families living in every house. Anyway, I'll talk about this next week. I'll continue. Remember my webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. Remember the coupon code JMCC for an extra discount on the whole house water filter. And the other webpage, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.